Same thing for football offenses. Quarterbacks have to be slipped into systems that best feature their skills. Very, very few players can make a bad fit work. Too often, though, teams think that the player makes the system rather than the other way around. It sends them hunting for a guy with obvious tools, a gun for an arm, mobility, around whom they figure they will build an offense. Walsh and his West Coast offense have proved that's just not how it works. Walsh always cautioned me, very few people can coach the quarterback, and even fewer can evaluate them. After more than 30 years in football, I can verify that that statement is 100% accurate. When it comes to the most important position in sports, biases, rationalizations, and willful ignorance all get in the way of dispassionate and accurate analysis. Even a genius like Walsh knew that it was an imperfect science, with exceptions to every rule. Drew Brees, it turns out, was not too short. Philip Rivers' slightly sidearm delivery works just fine. Kurt Warner's Arena League pedigree was good enough to get him to the Hall of Fame. But along the way, while studying Belichick as he searched for Brady's replacement, and by watching Walsh, Montana, and Young operating inside the West Coast offense, I've managed to compile a list of 7 quarterback qualities that, though not foolproof, have helped me formalize my beliefs on the quarterback evaluation process. 1. A winning way. Winning is a habit, Vince Lombardi said. Unfortunately, so is losing. Bill Parcells' golden rule was to draft prospects with at least 23 wins in college. It told him that a player knew what it took to be successful and was committed to doing the little things that got the job done. Now, 23 wins isn't a magic number, but it's a pretty good indicator. You can't bluff your way to 23 wins, not even in Pop Warner. Jameis Winston was 26-1 as a college starter. Marcus Mariota was 36-5, and Kirk Cousins was 27-12. That's a trio that is holding fairly steady in the pros after succeeding against top-tier college competition. The flip side may be the Chicago Bears' 2017 first-rounder Mitchell Trubisky. Trubisky started only 1 year at North Carolina, and his numbers caved against top 25 competition. Let's look at his yards per attempt in particular. The statistic is telling because it is a representation of what a quarterback is seeing and where he is looking. It's an eye-level test. Higher yards per attempt, say 7.5 or better, indicate a quarterback who is looking long, looking for big plays. Lower numbers indicate a quarterback who may be too concerned about being hit or is playing it safe and thus takes the quickest completion. In Cleveland, we learned the power of this statistic the hard way. When once great quarterback Bernie Kosar was nearing the end of his career, he was more concerned about his completion percentage than yards per attempt. During a game against Miami, Kosar was struggling, and Belichick pulled him from the game. Kosar argued, "How can you pull me? I'm 15 of 19. To which Belichick immediately snapped back out of the side of his mouth, "Yeah, for 82 yards. Kosar was spending too much time not getting sacked to realize that he was no longer doing the job we were paying him to do. Trubisky's yards per attempt average dropped from 8.3 to 6.2 against top 25 teams. Similarly, when he played from ahead, he averaged 9.1 yards per attempt versus 7.2 when he was behind. That's a fairly significant spread. Fans of Trubisky will blame the talent level that supported him for the discrepancy, but that's not how it works. The same teammates helped him to the good numbers, too. Meanwhile, Houston Texan Deshaun Watson, drafted the same year as Trubisky, averaged 7.7 yards per attempt when his team was ahead and 9.4 when it was down. In other words, he turned up the heat when his team needed it the most when it was time to catch up. By the way, Watson won 32 games in college. Trubisky, 8. If you believe in the rule of 23, you don't need to watch the next 5 seasons to know how these stories end. Number 2, a thick skin. The measure of who we are is how we react to something that does not go our way, says San Antonio Spurs head coach Greg Popovich. It's definitely a good measure of a quarterback as well. I always try to find a prospect who had already overcome adversity and not only on the field. If past performance is the best indicator of future achievement, those who have fought through bad times are likely to be able to do so again. The one thing every young quarterback can be certain of is that he will struggle mightily at some point. Even Peyton Manning went 3-13 as a rookie. Poor Troy Aikman finished 0-11 his first year, so I wanted to know how a prospect handled criticism and whether he let bad plays get to him. Winston won those 26 games in college despite throwing 28 interceptions. Yes, that's way too many. And yes, such misfires, which have continued in the pros, will keep him from the pinnacle of his profession if he doesn't clean them up. But say this about him. Those mistakes don't bother him. He comes off the field acting as if they are just part of the game, which they are. His mental toughness allows him to keep taking chances, to keep moving forward. Nobody questions Tom Brady's mental toughness, but after one of his rare interceptions, he tends to be a bit more careful with the ball for a couple series, avoiding throws into especially tight spots. I hate turnovers, but when I evaluate quarterbacks, I hate thin skin even more. 3. Work ethic. Your best player has to set a tone for intolerance for anything that gets in the way of winning, says NBA coach and TV analyst Jeff Van Gundy. Okay, so this is not an earth-shattering revelation, but you'd be surprised how many scouts ignore it. Do you think Jamarcus Russell was the hardest worker at LSU or Johnny Manziel at Texas A&M? Here's a hint. Taking care of your body is a pretty accurate indicator of commitment to the job. Being lazy gets in the way of winning. Think of recent quarterback busts. How many were truly hard workers? Ryan Leaf was 20 pounds overweight at his initial weigh-in. What kind of group rationalization did the Chargers brain trust have to engage in to convince itself that he was a worthy second overall pick? Your star quarterback needs to be a gym rat, pure and simple. First at practice, last to leave. It's not the only quality he needs, of course. Case in point, Tim Tebow. Too often, football suits believe they can change a player's work habits. Al Davis thought he could make Russell love the game enough to work as hard as he needed to. He found out soon enough that he couldn't. Why do teams like the Raiders and Chargers convince themselves that they can change a player's character? Hubris, for one thing, but it's mainly because every once in a while, a team gets lucky and pulls it off. There are, of course, exceptions to every one of these 7 quarterback qualities. None is bigger than Brett Favre's discovered work ethic. The Falcons drafted Favre near the top of the second round in 1991, but all he was in his rookie season was a disaster off the field. As Favre himself described it a few years later to a reporter, "I missed the team pitcher. I missed a couple of other things. I was late for meetings. I was surprised it took them that long to trade me." Of course, after getting traded to Green Bay, Favre became an all-time great. Guess the Packers ironed out his character flaws, right? Not so fast. Favre's issues were with alcohol, and he had to solve them for himself before he could become the player he did. Falcons coach Jerry Glanville tried everything in Atlanta, going so far as to drive around town asking bartenders not to serve his rookie quarterback. But in the end, he didn't have that kind of power. No one does. Assuming you can change a guy is magical thinking. 4. Football smarts. Here's the thing. Everyone watches game tape, but precious few benefit from it. Watching and studying are two different things. A quarterback who really studies tape will learn what the defense is trying to do. If he knows what he's looking for, he can also note individual strengths and weaknesses as well as the particulars of the attack. New Orleans quarterback Drew Brees is a tape nerd. He knows the personnel of every team's schemes and can ID all the adjustments made in each of them. Brees gets so obsessed as to be annoying. The kid in the front of the class with all the answers looking for more homework. Brady too. The 7 quarterback qualities often overlap like this. You need a great work ethic to study film long enough to build your football smarts. But on Sunday, that translates into wins. There's nothing the defense can do that will catch you by surprise. Well, almost nothing. Here's another classic exception to my seven quarterback qualities. In Super Bowl 51, on 3rd and 6, with just over 2 minutes left in the first half, Brady was expecting the same coverage from the Falcons, straight man-to-man, that they played 99% of the time in those situations. But as Brady let the ball go toward Danny Amendola, he didn't realize that the Falcons had made a slight modification to the safety's responsibilities. The next thing anyone knew, that safety, Robert Alford, was running the ball back 82 yards for a pick six. Let it be a lesson to everyone. If you want to beat Brady and the Pats, you have to try something a little different. Staying conventional is suicide. Brady, like Breeze, Aaron Rodgers, and a few others, knows that success on Sunday comes from time spent Monday through Saturday preparing yourself to think and play faster. A quick mind comes with preparation. You prepare so well that you don't have to think, you just react. This is hard for young players, though, because they often enter the NFL with little or no understanding of what it means to study tape, even though they obviously watch plenty of it in college. Don't blame their coaches. Blame the time restrictions of the NCAA, not to mention classroom responsibilities. Today's college offenses are controlled from the sidelines. Every play, every audible. Quarterbacks never have to call anything. But in the pros, radio communication between the coach and quarterback is shut off with 15 seconds on the play clock, and so quarterbacks are on their own. NFL games aren't just more complicated, they're also faster. So how quickly a quarterback can process information and make decisions often makes the difference between winning and losing. And that processing can only happen if a quarterback is football smart. It's not until they get to the NFL that a quarterback begins to understand the game's tiny crucial details, such as the leverage points of a defensive back or the side the receiver's defenders want to take away, the same way a basketball defender tries to take away an opponent's stronger hand. It takes time for a young passer to understand that when a blitz comes from the defensive backfield, the defender responsible for the blitzer's vacated area will cheat to that side, creating a hole in coverage and thus tipping off the blitz. Subtleties gleam from studying tape the correct way often make the difference between a Pro Bowl quarterback and a draft bust. This truly scary thing from a personnel standpoint is that no matter how much you vet a college quarterback, it will always be a 50-50 gamble. Why? Because you simply can't measure his ultimate football smarts and how he'll react to the speed and complications of the pro game until he gets under the center on a Sunday. 5. Innate ability. Some quarterbacks are just born with such instincts and intuition, Walsh wrote in his book Finding the Winning Edge. As a rule, there is not much coaches can do to develop this area. I'm no geneticist, but I can tell you that when Tom Brady's mom first took him in her arms, he already had somewhere in his DNA the fundamental quarterback requirements, tangible and intangible. Obviously, he would need to develop some tools, the arm, the foot movement, the rush-avoiding quickness, the sense of timing. But the core of what makes him who he is on the field today was pretty much there already. I understand how subjective this born with it quality is, but I don't care. Walsh couldn't define it either, but he knew it when he saw it, and I believe in it too. Speaking of it, from all indications, Deshaun Watson has it. I mean, the guy started in high school and college as a freshman. On the other hand, Miami Dolphins fans will tell you that Ryan Tannehill was no quarterback in the crib. Athlete, yes, but a natural for the position? Don't think so. In fact, in high school, Tannehill didn't become the starter until his junior year, and he was only a 3-star recruit, listed as an athlete, not a quarterback. At Texas A&M, he was even moved to wide receiver for 2 years before starting 6 games at quarterback as a junior. Sure, he impressed a lot of people as the starter on a solid team as a senior, but you couldn't exactly argue that Tannehill was a natural. Whatever that certain thing is, he lacks it, and that is what's holding him back in the pros. Because he is not an instinctive player, he doesn't play as fast as he needs to. Don't get me wrong, he's capable of good things, it's just that he doesn't seem to be capable of fast things. The best indication of this is his play on third down, when blitzes and passing situations speed up considerably. Tannehill's career third down numbers, 26 interceptions, 0.5 yard less per attempt than his overall average, and a 58% completion rate versus 63% overall. When the game pushes him, Tannehill is less productive. If Walsh were still around, he would be telling the Dolphins they need to start looking for a new quarterback, one with more innate ability. 6. Carriage. The University of Connecticut's women's basketball coach, Gino Auriemma, benches players, even stars, if he doesn't like the way they are carrying themselves, correcting the problem before it subverts the team. How long do you imagine would quarterback Jay Cutler be stuck on Geno's bench? You don't think body language is important? Ask Bears fans. I think Cutler would still be playing in Soldier Field if his sideline posture indicated he was even a little interested. At times, he has looked as if he'd sooner sit in a dentist chair than get back in the game. Cutler has problems on the field too, sure, but they are compounded by the way he responds to them. He acts like he just doesn't give a damn. I don't get it. His coaches in Chicago and Miami must have known that his lousy body language would kill credibility among his teammates almost faster than his poor play would. Quarterbacks have to inspire, and if they can't always do it with pinpoint throws and blitz-facing courage, everyone has a bad day, they can always look as if they have it all under control and that somehow they will figure out how to lead the team to victory. No one wants to follow a sulker. Exception, Cam Newton is a Heisman Trophy winner, a number one overall NFL draft pick, and an MVP even though he hunkers down under a towel, argues with coaches, and storms out of press conferences. Go figure. However, he hasn't yet led his team to a Super Bowl win. So, 7. Leadership. Quarterbacks who fail to gain the respect of teammates leave a team rudderless. When teams I worked for were in the market for a quarterback, we made sure we knew what the teammates of any prospective hires were saying about the guy, off the record, of course. Is his competitiveness contagious or overbearing? Are players willing to go to war with him? Does he command the huddle? Finding the truth isn't easy. College coaches used to be a good source for this kind of stuff, but lately they have become adept at talking up their prospects because they want their guys to make it to the league, and not just for the players' sake. Pros promote programs. Therefore, scouts have to dig deeper to get what they need, even if it's not what we want to hear. A recent very high pick was dinged by his college teammates. Check that. They flat out hated him. They refused to attend his private workouts, for heaven's sake. But the team that drafted him chose to ignore all that, and today most of his teammates he had feel exactly the same way his college teammates did. Trust me, injuries are not the only reason Robert Griffin III has had such a hard time finding a job. Gil Brandt, the Cowboys' legendary personnel guy, once told me, "The best time to draft a quarterback is when you don't need one." It's actually one piece of advice I got to pass along to Belichick. In New England before the 2014 draft, we had a meeting to make sure we were focused on finding a player to replace Tom Brady, on the assumption that someday, eventually, perhaps, he was actually going to have to retire. The current backup, Ryan Mallett, was entering his final season under contract, and we knew he was not the answer. When we drafted Mallett, he looked to have all the skills. Unfortunately, he lacked the maturity and work ethic to play at the next level. Guys like that are exceedingly frustrating to coach because they never see that they are wasting their talents. We gave Mallett time to shape up, but he didn't, and it became time to move on. Brady was coming off a subpar season for him, with his lowest quarterback rating since 2003. But nobody thought he was anywhere close to finish, so the timing was perfect. Whoever we selected would have at least a couple of years to get ready away from the spotlight. The draft had many prospects, Blake Bortles of Central Florida, Johnny Manziel of Texas A&M, Teddy Bridgewater of Louisville, Derek Carr of Fresno State, and Jimmy Garoppolo of Eastern Illinois. Choosing near the bottom of the first round was going to prevent us from having our pick of the group. Still, the offensive staff, mostly Josh McDaniels, the quarterback coach and offensive coordinator, spent time watching tape on them all and then narrowing the field. Fresh off my time in Cleveland, I was up to speed on our options because I had spent considerable time assessing each quarterback for the Browns. By the time McDaniels and Belichick had completed their tape study, we were down to two, Manziel and Garoppolo. I admit that I was fascinated by Manziel, despite his lack of height, and loved how Garoppolo dominated his level of competition. This might not have swayed Al Davis, but it was enough for me. Manziel had a boatload of off-the-field issues that we had to research to separate fact from fiction. Garoppolo stood out in almost every area, but spending time with him would help us determine whether he could duplicate his skill set at this level and grow in our offense. One directive Belichick kept pounding into us was that we were not looking to duplicate Brady. Whoever we drafted, the offense would have to do some adapting to his strengths, spoken like a true Walsh devotee. This is not to suggest that we would overhaul the offense, but once we understood the new guy's strength, we would feature plays and wrinkles to highlight them. When Brady took over for Drew Bledsoe, the Patriots tweaked the offense by making it slightly less vertical, increasing the focus on timing routes and the tight end as a weapon. When big play wide receiver Randy Moss arrived, the Patriots tweaked their attack once more to take advantage of his incredible speed and downfield threat. Belichick might not be much for change, but he's a big believer in adaptation. When potential draft picks come to New England for a visit, it's not a recruiting trip. Belichick has zero interest in being a salesman for the program. He just wants to find the truth about each player. Players meet with all divisions of the football operations, then sit alone with McDaniels as they watch tape. At some point, they have to explain the plays they are watching and then learn some basics of our playbook. After lunch, the players are put through a walkthrough of the plays that they learned. Once this is over, they meet with Belichick, who, like any great trial lawyer, has all the answers to the questions before he asks them. After Manziel and Garoppolo headed to their next NFL destinations, Belichick held a meeting to review the day. All of the coaches in the session felt that both men passed muster as far as being able to learn the offense and not being overwhelmed by their potential proximity to a legend. But Manziel had those issues that would not be cleared in a one-day visit. Garoppolo, in contrast, just had it. I swear he seemed like a living embodiment of my seven quarterback qualities. After we selected him in the second round, it became clear that everything we thought about him was dead on. There was a quiet confidence in whatever he did. He was a great worker. His football smarts were off the charts, and he carried himself like a leader at all times. Was he throwing spirals from the crib? Probably. He quickly bonded with the offensive lineman and was respectful towards Brady even as he competed to win a spot as his backup. For someone who has studied quarterback prospects for 30 years, how to find them, evaluate them, and develop them, it was a very exciting and interesting time. Everything just felt right. Everything except the timing, it turns out. More on that in Chapter 9, but I will say this. Watching Garoppolo's style and mannerisms, Walsh would have wanted this kid, and remember, spoiler alert, whatever Bill wants, Bill gets. Chapter 6, Defense, Where Simplicity is Complex. Times were simpler. Defenses didn't move as fast, and the quarterback was often the best athlete. Now he's being chased by the best athletes. Bill Walsh. You know that game people play where they name their dream dinner companions? In the spring of 2016, I actually got to live one of mine. Before the draft that year, Bill Belichick and I traveled to the University of Alabama to evaluate the school's talent at its annual pro day. There, we also caught up with Nick Saban, a friend of mine who was the defensive coordinator on the Cleveland Browns staff and a friend of Bill's even before that. When the Crimson Tide's pro day was over, the three of us headed to Saban's house near campus for dinner and conversation about, what else? Football. Whenever I finish a lengthy phone call with Belichick, my wife Millie always asks me, "Do you two talk about anything other than football?" The answer, of course, is no. Hey, you talk about what you love, and we love football. The only other person I know who loves to chat about the gridiron as much as we do is Saban. As we left campus, he informed us that his wife, Miss Terry, was not going to be home. That meant the three of us football nerds didn't even have to pretend to be interested in anything but ball. We practically raced to Saban's house. It was going to be a real man cave dinner with a single course, defense. Imagine my luck that evening, being a fly on the wall at a long and uninterrupted dinner with perhaps the two greatest football coaches in history, men who have enjoyed a long, symbiotic, and a successful history of pushing and challenging each other to perfect their sometimes disparate defensive styles and philosophies. Even before they were together in Cleveland, Belichick and Saban would meet at West Point or points along the road to discuss different ways to create the all-important pass rush. Saban and Belichick agreed that pressuring the quarterback was the best way to slow down any aerial attack in the pass-happy era. They just didn't quite agree on how to accomplish it. On this matter, Belichick offered a staunch conservative counterpoint to Saban's screaming liberal all-out pressure on every down and from everywhere approach. But each saw the merits of the other's position, and ultimately neither was above borrowing a little from the other and blending it into his own philosophy. When they reconnected for dinner in Alabama, the timing couldn't have been better. Saban had just defeated the high-powered Clemson offense for the national championship, although the Tigers, led by Deshaun Watson, put 40 points on the famed Crimson Tide defense. It sounds incredible, but despite the win, Saban was still fuming over that defensive performance. As I said, sometimes these guys seem like twins. For both of them, their moods are never a reflection of the score. It's about the execution. And Saban is far too savvy to pretend that his team wasn't lucky to prevail. Clemson ran over and through Saban's defense by using the spread attack that has been popular in the college game for some time. What made the dinner conversation so intriguing to Belichick was that the up-tempo spread was becoming increasingly commonplace in the NFL as well, ever since Chip Kelly, late of the Oregon Ducks, had brought his version to the Philadelphia Eagles a few years earlier. Belichick could not have cared less about the menu that night or Saban's spectacular home. He wanted to pick Nick's brain about stopping the game's newest offensive wrinkle. The NFL has a version of the run-pass option. Two plays are called in the huddle, one run, one pass, and the quarterback determines which to go with once he gets to the line and peruses the defensive formation. In college, though, the run-pass option adds a wrinkle, the spread formation from which teams either hand off the ball or fake the handoff and throw a pass. They can do this because, unlike in the NFL, college offensive linemen can be as much as 3 yards downfield, which means they can always block as if it's for a run play, regardless of whether the offense ends up throwing a pass. In professional football, it's illegal for linemen to be so far downfield, and anyway, most, if not all, teams would be reluctant to run the option this way for fear of getting their quarterback clobbered. Nevertheless, Belichick was eager to understand how Saban planned his counterattack. Between bites, Saban went into all of it in depth. Trying not to sound like too much of a fanboy, I have to say this discourse was amazing. Not just the scheme, but the way he could make even the most complicated pieces of this puzzle seem simple and easy to digest. Belichick wasn't particularly interested in the micro, the countless adjustments to each of the calls. What he wanted to hear more about was Saban's broad philosophy. Belichick would figure out the particulars himself. That was how they always did things when they worked together. In 1991, when Belichick became the head coach in Cleveland, he inherited a team that allowed 462 points, 28.8 points per game. In just 1 year, he and Saban dropped that number to 298, and in 1994, the last time Cleveland won a playoff game, the Belichick-Saban defense gave up just 204 points, 12.7 per game. They did it with a defense they invented called Red 2. Red 2, which is often credited to Saban, but was truthfully a joint creation, was a match coverage. Depending on the pass routes, receivers would be defended man-to-man or passed off as they crossed into and through different areas of the field. Essentially, it was football's version of a matchup zone in basketball, and it was used mainly when football offenses were in the red zone. It had different rules and guiding principles than a typical cover two because it defended a more contracted space and it was hard for the players to understand at first. In fact, my colleagues got sick of me walking around the office saying that learning Red 2 could double as the entrance exam for Harvard. But before long, it became clear that Red 2 was a keeper. In the Red 2, a corner was responsible for carrying a receiver for a distance before passing him to a safety and waiting for another receiver to enter his area and become his responsibility. What made the Red 2 so hard to learn, but nearly impossible to game plan against, was that each week it could be tailored specifically to the opponent's passing designs. One week the corner might carry a receiver for 10 yards through his zone, and the next week he might cover him for just 8, depending on any number of factors: matchups, scores, personnel, speed, injuries. The parameters could and often would change. It was taxing on the brain, but very effective on the field. That night, he boiled it down for us to a single tenet. More than anything, the goal was to make sure that the run-force player, the defender who forced a rushing play in a certain direction, was never compromised. Setting an edge to contain an outside run and redirecting it inside toward the teeth of the defense had to be the defender's primary focus, so much so that he needed to be free of the responsibility of handling pass plays too. Whatever the adjustments or sacrifices needed to occur in coverage schemes to make that happen, well, they just had to get done. Between courses, Belichick peppered Saban with so many questions. If they double your defensive end, then what? And what do you do if the quarterback steps up in the pocket? And could a screen work if you threw it over the end? That we were dishing out dessert before I knew it. Looking back, my dream dinner had little to do with the food and everything to do with the high-level theoretical conversation. The meal was tasty, yes, but the seminar offered by two of the greatest football minds ever was much more filling and fulfilling. And it inspired me to create my own philosophy about the 11 essential rules of good defense. Bon appetit. Number one, the disguise is as important as the defense. In the movie The Usual Suspects, the small-time con artist with cerebral palsy, Roger Verbal Kent, regales U.S. Customs agent David Kuyan with tales of an elaborate heist scheme and a mysterious man named Kaiser Sose. Verbal's grand story about the villainous, enigmatic Sose includes the most classic movie quotes of all time. "The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist," which, fun fact, is actually a rephrasing of a line from the 19th century French poet Charles Baudelaire. When it comes to disguising defenses, Belichick is the NFL's version of Kaiser Sose, without the murderous impulses, of course. At his peak as a defensive coordinator in the mid-1980s, with everyone watching and trying to reverse engineer his schemes, the tight-lipped Belichick convinced everyone that the New York Giants' defense was nothing more than 3-4 cover 2 with no complexity to it. He convinced the football world that the important wrinkles in his attack didn't exist by aligning in the same front and showing the same coverage look on every play. Most teams vary their fronts and coverage shells on first and second down to confuse the opposing quarterback, not Belichick. He brings a level of confusion and disguise after every snap that keeps most quarterbacks up at night. Belichick kept up the Kaiser Sose act even with his friends and colleagues. When I asked him about disguising his defense in 1991, he told me that, in fact, the 3-4 cover 2 was his only call. He wasn't lying. But in what some might consider classic Belichick fashion, he wasn't being entirely truthful either. Yes, the call was 3-4 cover 2, but what the defense did out of it depended on the strengths and weaknesses of the particular opponent, not just from week to week, but from play to play. For example, just before the snap on an obvious passing down in Belichick's base 3-4, it might look like the outside linebacker was lined up to rush the edge, but a split second after the snap, Belichick would drop the outside linebacker back into coverage and blitz the inside linebacker through the interior line, all because the last second switch created a better matchup with a lesser blocker. On the next play, he might slant his entire defensive front to the strong side to combat a strong side run team. The layers of complexity were subtle and the modifications slight, but they allowed Belichick to use what seemed like 35 custom defenses in a single game, which shifted the tactical advantage to his team's side. Anyone who wanted to believe the tweaks didn't exist was making a huge mistake, just like the Saps and the Usual Suspects. Belichick's simplicity-first ruse on defense was inspired by Washington Redskins Hall of Fame head coach Joe Gibbs. Gibbs was a masterful offensive tactician with a scheme that featured a power running game that won 3 Super Bowls under 3 different quarterbacks, none of whom are household names. Think about that the next time you're engaged in one of those best football coaches of all time debates. His offense appeared complex on first glance, but when Belichick broke it down, he found that it all could be reduced to 13 base plays, 3 runs, 10 passes. Gibbs believed, as Belichick does, that repetition breeds execution. All those basic Redskin plays, however, were executed out of and disguised by myriad formations, looks, shifts, and personnel groupings that turned 13 vanilla plays into 130 complicated and mysterious plays. For the quarterback, though, no matter what went on before the snap, by the time he dropped back to pass, all the routes in front of him looked just like they always did. Similarly, by the time the ball was in the running back's hands, the blocking scheme and running lanes before him looked exactly the same. Gibbs' playbook had 13 pages. Everything else was window dressing, used to keep defenses in the dark and on their heels, constantly worried that the devil that didn't think existed was actually playing tricks on them. Before he became a head coach, remember, Belichick competed against Gibbs twice a year as the Giants' defensive coordinator, and what he saw in that camouflage offense had a major impact on him. On the first day as a head coach, in fact, Belichick walked into the Browns' headquarters and declared that we would adopt the Skins model. Core plays disguised with various looks and personnel groups to create confusion. New plays don't win consistently, he preached. Using old plays in new ways does. Number 2, studying an offense is the first step towards stopping it. Battles on the gridiron are much like battles on the chessboard. In each case, grandmasters know their opponent's tendencies and spend time studying game plans in styles reminiscent of their own. When Belichick sits down to study an offense, he doesn't read the press clippings or fixate on the win-loss record. Instead, he watches tape of teams that play a scheme similar to his own base scheme to learn how his upcoming opponent attacked it. Knowing the opponent's offense or defensive coordinator is critical too, so he maintains a thick file on all the men holding those jobs. The more he knows about them, the better he can anticipate what they'll do in key game situations. When Belichick arrived in Cleveland and I was the pro personnel advance man, we would meet each week to discuss the next opponent, and those meetings began with a debrief about the coordinators. From background to football influences and finally to recent games, he wanted to know as much about the coaches as he did the players because, like chess champion Bobby Fischer, he wanted to know how he was going to be attacked. The movie A Beautiful Mind was based on the life of another troubled genius, John Nash, the renowned mathematician who made fundamental contributions to game theory and the study of partial differential equations. Yeah, me neither. In the film, Nash's office shows a desk covered with papers and drawings and a blackboard filled with all sorts of equations and no more room to write. Maybe all geniuses think and work alike, but I swear Belichick's office looks just like Nash's. The coach's conference table was always covered in stacks of paper, or as we called them, the pads. The pads are Belichick's version of Warren Buffett's massive, in-depth pre-investment research. The due diligence required to make a correct evaluation of a company, though in this case, the company is an opposing team. To own an offense, first you have to know how it works. But incredibly, most teams misidentify what opponents do best because they don't spend enough time studying them. Every week, defensive coaches around the NFL talk about stopping the run. But which run? From what formation towards what direction? And even if you do go deep enough with your analysis, that's only half the work. Now you have to figure out the right way to counter. Say they love to run left. Do you match your primary run defender against their best blocker, like against like, or do you try to free him? Nor is the answer to simply show an 8-man front. If that idea worked all the time, no team would ever gain a yard on the ground. In fact, general solutions often create more problems. No, it's never as simple as stop the run. Those pads all over Belichick's cluttered office were his defense against this kind of fatal flaw. Essentially, there were plays from the game tape printed out on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper with the precise movements of each member of the offense and defense delineated. And when I say precise, I mean precise. Padding the games was a job for a young wannabe coaches. It took at least 4 or 5 hours to do a game to make sure Belichick would have the exact details he needed in front of him. The notes on each play went far beyond just basic X's and O's. For starters, Belichick wants to know how, when, where, and why every player on the field moved during every play. He wants to know, for example, if there's a variation of even a couple of inches in the offensive line splits, or if the quarterback likes to throw to his right, or is especially deadly on out patterns. Josh McDaniels, the Patriots' offensive coordinator, began his coaching career padding games. After handing over the first few, he got them returned with color-coded post-its highlighting his various mistakes and omissions. Belichick takes great pride and pleasure in helping and developing young assistants, and with McDaniels, he had basically graded his work, adding colored lines to indicate more accurately the movement of the play on both sides of the ball, and entering a host of extra data. McDaniels is a proud and competitive man. It didn't take long until he was padding a game in under 4 hours, fully confident there would be no boomerang post-it notes. Belichick believes that coaches who learn their craft by padding games are much better coaches on Sunday, even though the task is so labor-intensive that it basically requires them to go without sleep. It's exhausting work, and Belichick knows it because he often padded games himself. But to him, learning every detail of how an offense plans to attack is far more valuable than rest. 3. Don't coach defense, teach it. In a very real way, Bill Walsh once wrote, everything I did was teaching in some manner or other. The truth is that at their core, all good coaches are great teachers and communicators. The trait ran deep in Belichick's family. His mom, Jeanette, was a teacher who spoke 7 languages and had a lifetime subscription to The New Yorker. Lou Holtz, the former Notre Dame head coach, often asked his assistants, are you a schemer or a teacher? He wanted to know if they were more interested in doodling plays or teaching teams how to win. Blackboard coaching is a killer. Schemes drawn up in classrooms are undefeated. Whoever has the chalk last wins. On blackboards across the league, there are elaborate defenses being created that, in 2 dimensions at least, seem certain to shut down any offense. In real life, doodles usually don't translate, but teaching always does. Sometimes that's because although they might look incredible, what the play diagrams represent on the field isn't so smart at all. Or worse, players can't properly execute what the doodle demands. But more often than not, the problem is that players don't understand what they're being asked to do. And that's the fault of the coach, not the doodles. When the TV cameras cut to a coach on a sideline after his defense has just allowed a big play, even amateur lip readers can see the frustrated man saying some version of, "What are we doing?" We can't hear the response, obviously, but honestly, it doesn't matter. If the coach is asking that question, it's probably because in some ways the players were too. If someone has been left wide open, it's because the players didn't know what they were doing, and that happened because the coaches didn't help them understand their responsibilities when they had the chance. George Seifert, Walsh's defensive coordinator with the Niners before becoming his successor, was a brilliant assistant, innovative, creative, and not intimidated by a West Coast offense his unit had to face every day in practice. What really set him apart as coordinator, though, was his teaching skills. Seifert knew how to transfer what was in those elaborate schemes he drew up, the concepts, the assignments, the visual keys, and even the physical requirements into execution on the field by his players, much to the chagrin of the crusty scouts on the payroll. Those old-timers often complained to me that Seifert's playbook was too big and too hard to learn, and the defense was a reactionary game, not a thinking game. Seifert proved them wrong year in and year out. He didn't just draw a doodle of a race car. He knew how to build it and how to teach people to drive it. He knew how to implement his schemes. In Cleveland, our defensive backfield coach and later defensive coordinator was a great teacher named Rick Venturi. Over the years, Venturi had mastered the extremely complicated Red 2 scheme from top to bottom and even added his own variations and twists to it. But Venturi's real genius lay in knowing the defense so well that he understood its one shortcoming. It was really difficult to teach. He often warned young members of his staff that learning Red 2 is not natural for the players. It's hard to understand and harder to perform. Not everyone was ready to learn or even play match coverage, and even fewer of us were ready to teach it. How well we taught our players was going to make the difference between success and failure. Venturi knew that just because something like handing off receivers looked great on the blackboard, that didn't mean it necessarily looked great on the field. What Venturi taught us all in Cleveland is that the greatest scheme in the world is only as good as the coaches teaching it. 4. Make the offense play left-handed. This is a classic Belichick tactic, taking offenses out of their comfort zones by preventing them from doing what they do best. Former longtime NFL offensive coordinator Jim Schaffner, who was the interim head coach of the Browns before Belichick, described what his successor did as making you play left-handed. Of course, everyone in the game is trying to do this, but what makes Belichick different, what makes him worthy of Schaffner's catchphrase, is the way he commits to his plan. Take the way the Patriots played the Colts with Peyton Manning under center, running back Edgerrin James, receivers Reggie Wayne and Marvin Harrison. That's some offensive firepower, but after padding a few of the Colts' games, Belichick learned he could neutralize that explosiveness by setting a hard edge to keep James from getting around the corner and up the field. Belichick game planned to set the edge no matter what. Even if he had to commit two extra players and run the rest of the scheme with 9 defenders, he would do it. And if Manning hit a few long passes or if the Colts gashed the middle of the defense for back-to-back first downs, so be it. Most coaches, of course, would instantly abandon their edge-first scheme at the first sign of weakness, but not Belichick. If the Colts ever discovered the discipline to ditch the outside running game and just blast away on the inside, instead, the Patriots would have been in big trouble all those years. Because he knew Manning and the Colts almost better than they knew themselves, though, Belichick counted on them growing bored with an inside run game, so the Patriots would double Harrison, use their best corner to contain Wayne, and wait for Manning to force the ball into double coverage. All that study and Belichick's brilliant mind led to a game plan with one goal: take away what the Colts do best and force the other players to step up. That's making them play left-handed. Belichick's overall record against Manning-led Colts, 12-8. Belichick takes away what the opposing team does best, but he also takes away what specific players do best. It's a subtle but crucial difference. He personally breaks down every offensive player to understand his strengths within a team's scheme. Then he moves around his defense's talents to best serve the system he has created for the week. Most teams put their best corner on the best receiver. Naturally, Belichick does the opposite. As he did with the Colts, he doubles the best receiver with his second and third corners so that he can line up his best corner against the second best receiver and create two matchup advantages. Similarly, Belichick doesn't see all-pro Atlanta receiver Julio Jones as a classic Z receiver. He sees him as the one man the defense needs to stop. When the Falcons have to make a play, wise men expect the ball to go to Jones. Belichick is a wise man. Hence the double coverage on Jones. Take away the player who can hurt you, force Matt Ryan to find someone else, and the Falcons are playing left-handed. Say the opponent is an excellent running team, which the folks watching at home know because the announcers have thrown the relevant stats at them. Team X is 3rd in the NFL in rushing. But that fact means nothing to Belichick. He wants to know where they gain those yards. Off right tackle? Over left guard? Once he has isolated the player who triggers an offensive tendencies, he can put his best rundown player for many years, nose tackle Vince Wilfork, at the exact spot that will cause the most debilitating roadblock. 5. Timing is everything, so disrupt your opponents. When Manning came to Foxborough for the 2004 AFC Divisional Playoff game, the Colts' offense had been virtually impossible to slow down during the season or in the wildcard victory against the Broncos when they scored 7 touchdowns in 10 possessions. That offense was nowhere to be found on January 16th against the Patriots. The Colts had the ball for barely 22 minutes and scored 3 points. 1 week, the Colts were unstoppable. The next, they were on their way home. Did Belichick install an elaborate scheme that befuddled Manning? No. In fact, he simplified his plan by going old school and roughing up receivers, legally, as they ran their routes. Again, here's Belichick the pragmatist. If the Colts' record-setting offense is based on timing between the quarterback and the receivers, the easiest way to defend it is to throw a wrench into that intricate mechanism. Belichick did it through the art of rerouting, hitting a receiver on his route to alter his prescribed direction. Rerouting is not holding or interference. It's a stab or a push intended to momentarily disrupt and effectively blow up the precise timing of a pass play. It's a technique he mastered under Bill Parcells in New York. A little messed up timing plus an on-rushing linebacker meant big trouble for the offense, plain and simple. It got its best workout in the Giants' many high-stake battles against Bill Walsh's West Coast offense. Belichick realized that the only way to slow down such a well-choreographed attack was to bully its receivers. Need more proof? Just ask Isaac Bruce, Torrey Holt, and the rest of the greatest show on turf Rams, the ones who lost to the Patriots in Super Bowl 36. I got a full-blown education on the art of rerouting during my second season with Belichick in Cleveland. After each game, I joined the defensive staffers, ostensibly to help them review our performance, but mostly to listen and learn from their analysis. With Saban controlling the video, I sat most quietly as linebacker coach Al Groh and line coach Jim Bates went over every detail of their unit's work. Rerouting had become such a huge element of our schemes that opponents would specifically attack the area of the field where the reroute occurred. For instance, offenses would run a seam route down the middle of the field just to occupy the linebacker. Meanwhile, they send a receiver across the field to the exact spot the linebacker had vacated. I love this kind of checkmate aspect of football strategy. The play, which we called a seam crosser, was a surefire way to exploit Belichick's emphasis on rerouting, but only if they could get the rerouter to commit on the seam route. So checkmate. Saban and Groh instructed their linebackers to punch, disrupt, and then turn back to cover the next crosser. This heavy-handed physical tactic enraged many pass-happy teams, but none more than Peyton Manning-era Colts and their general manager Bill Polian. Polian grew tired of seeing Belichick's Patriots bang around his receivers. After the 2004 AFC playoff game, he only said, "I give the Patriots credit for what they did. I won't go beyond that." Unfortunately for New England, Polian also happened to be a member of the NFL's competition committee. And by the next season, wouldn't you know it, the NFL was instructing officials to enforce its illegal contact rule more strictly. In the current era of intricately timed passing offenses, disruption remains the key. But Polian made sure that playing defense beyond the 5-yard grace area, especially against rhythm passing games, would be much more difficult from then on. It didn't matter that Polian was thinking only about his Colts when he led the charge to enforce illegal contact and help hurry up offenses and intricately timed passing schemes. Suddenly, the scales were tipped toward the passing game, and further rulebook tweaks just put a thumb on that scale. Belichick being Belichick, though, didn't complain or why, or lobby the competition committee. He rebuilt his own offense using the rule change he inspired and won 3 more Super Bowls with it. 6. Diffuse explosive plays. In 1994, when the Browns headed to Dallas for a late Saturday afternoon game, making the Cowboys play left-handed wasn't going to be easy. That offense featured Michael Irvin at wideout, Jay Novacek at tight end, the man who would become the NFL's all-time leading rusher, Emmitt Smith, and maybe most of all, future Hall of Famer Troy Aikman. The boys were so loaded that they didn't have a left hand. The closest thing they had to a left hand was wide receiver Alvin Harper, who would have been a primary option on most other teams. If we couldn't make them play left-handed, we could do the next best thing, take away their big play potential with short tackling and an awareness of where their chunk plays came from. Most NFL teams convert about 35% of their third downs, and that's not going to get you down the field. A drive is far more likely to end up putting points on the board if it includes at least one run or pass of more than 20 yards. When coaches talk about a game or an entire season coming down to just a handful of key plays, this is what they're talking about. Belichick's plan for Dallas was simple. We let them have their catches and yards as long as they didn't get too many yards all at once. And it worked. Smith got his 100-plus yards, but it took him 26 carries to get them. Irvin had 7 catches, but the longest went for 18 yards. The longest play of the day was a 26-yard run by Smith. We held the boys to 14 points and won. I always laugh when a defensive coach says, besides that one 55-yard play, we play great run defense. A great run defense doesn't give up 55-yard runs. You know what else a great defense doesn't do? They don't erase outlying plays from the record of the game. They focus on them and try to understand how they were allowed to happen so that they don't happen again. On the jubilant plane ride back from Dallas, Belichick did not say, if you ignore that one long run from Smith, we held him to 86 yards on 25 carries. He said, we did a good job of fixing the edge after Smith gained those 26 yards on the second drive of the game, which is why we held him to 86 yards on 25 carries the rest of the way. 7. Remember Newton's second law. When Saban ran our defense in Cleveland, he wanted to be in the perfect defense for each play. The thought of giving up 5 yards drove him as crazy as giving up 50. His impossible dream manifested in countless checks and adjustments before the snap of the ball. Decades later, you can still watch an Alabama game and see all the defenders looking toward the sideline for his last second adjustments. Belichick is the exact opposite. In fact, before we hired him as our head coach in Cleveland, I told Belichick that I had watched him on the sidelines at a Giants game and noticed his hands in the pocket of his red starter jacket and asked him where he kept his call sheet. And in classic Belichick fashion, he said, I call the same thing every play. Why do I need a call sheet? Belichick prefers to work with few checks and adjustments because above all, he wants his defense playing fast. He wants them doing, not wondering what to do. He wants them reacting, not thinking. He hates mistakes, but if they happen, he wants them to happen while his defense is going 110 miles per hour. Defensive team speed starts with the middle linebacker, the Mike. He is the quarterback of the defense and needs to be both mentally and physically fast. He is the one responsible for calling the defenses and getting everyone positioned correctly before the snap. But he is also the one who dictates the tempo. A Mike who can get from sideline to sideline in the run game and fulfill coverage or attacking assignments in the pass game keeps a team moving apace. The best indicator of a fast defense, forced fumbles. I'm sure you're familiar with Newton's second law of motion, but in case it has slipped your mind, here's a refresher. Acceleration is directly proportional to net force because net force equals mass times acceleration. Newton probably wasn't thinking about football, but he could have been. When a defender hits a ball carrier, the best thing that can happen is that the ball comes loose. And when a faster, bigger defender hits a ball carrier, Newton says the ball is that much more likely to come loose. Show me a defense with a low number of forced fumbles, and I will show you a defense with a slower-than-average Mike. Show me a fast-thinking, fast-moving defense, and I will show you harder hits, more balls on the ground, and, all other things being equal, more wins. 8. Think pressure first, sack second. It seems like every great coach in history has an opinion on the art and science of blitzing. Vince Lombardi once said blitzing is a form of weakness. When he coached, that might have been true. Back then, A blitz meant sending six or seven men toward the quarterback while the secondary covered the receivers man-to-man. If the defensive front couldn't get to the quarterback, the whole unit was in trouble. Of course, in those days, with the limitations placed on offensive linemen in regard to using their hands,